Right on that hip, too. Right on the bad hip. Look at that. Bar 400 and some on pound. Look at
him. Oh, my goodness. What are they trying to do to him?
I'll tell you what they're doing. They're going to end this career. That's what they're trying to do.
They're going to send him back to the doctor again. You mean to tell me we're going to have to watch one of those bloody operations?
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Rusty Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome to episode 75 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, in what was a last-minute decision, I boarded an airplane on Sunday night not knowing what show I was going to do, so I scrolled through the strategic reserve that I keep on my iPod Touch so I don't have to worry about Wi-Fi. With this being a Southwest flight, it was going to cost $8, and for a couple of hours from Chicago, it's not really worth it. And I came upon the WWF Superstars of Wrestling, as you could probably tell from the theme, from November 14th, 1987. So it's been about 25, 26 shows since I've done WWF 1987, which when I started this show, I thought I was going to be doing that virtually every single week, like once a month, WWF 87. And I think this is only the third, maybe the fourth one that I've done. I know I said the same thing with WCW 1991 last week. And I am trying to plan out shows ahead of time in my notebook, which is actually brand new. There are some people who are fascinated by the giant notebook that I take notes for these shows in, looking in your direction, Mike Crockett. But I've actually planned out the next six or seven shows. Now, it's all subject to change. Some of them are written in, well, actually, they're all written in pen, but some of them are subject to change. But I'm still going to take it week to week. But we got some late 87 WWF today, which is always quite fun to look back on. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon to make your Amazon purchases. And we're coming up in September to the Place to Be podcast 500th episode, and there will be a trivia contest that I will be assisting in some role in developing questions, and I need to get cracking on that. I have a lot of various questions that could go in. The only thing that I am worried about is my tendency maybe to make certain questions a little too obscure, because I like to dig really deep into things, which you'd know just from listening to this show. Like, who did Gene Okerlund call in that episode of All American Wrestling? Can't really do a trivia question like that, because this is not a multiple choice kind of thing. It's going to be something more simple, and there is a template for me to go on, so there is that. I also have a podcast coming. It'll come up before SummerSlam, another edition of the Adams Division podcast with Steve Bennett, the sportscasters. We'll be looking at the first 11 SummerSlams and ranking them in the same spirit as the WrestleMania podcast we did back in April. Also, the ongoing greatest WWE tag team project on Place to Be Nation. Hope you're following along with that. I am gathering my research for that. So many disparate tag teams that I have to consider. Everything from Mark Jindrak all the way to Boris Zukov, who is on the show in one of the early appearances of good old Boris in the WWF. But before getting into all the show, you know, I have my little vanity segment where I kind of talk about what I did the previous weekend, and I promise I try to keep this short, but I went to Chicago. That's why I did a show for WCW on WGN last week. I try to theme things around what it is I happen to be doing. Since I'm going to Minneapolis next month, for God knows what reason, to watch a Tigers-Twins weekend series. I mean, I could just be suckered into any sort of baseball thing if you just talk to me long enough about it. Probably do an AWA show then. So I was in Chicago over the weekend, flew in on Thursday, and flew out Sunday night at a rather obscene hour, but I'll get to that in just a second. Went to the Cubs game on Saturday night. They had a doubleheader, which was a split admission, so they played a game at 12 o'clock, and then the second game was at 6:15, so I'm just following the first game on my phone, like, get this game over with so that, you know, you can go into the park at a normal time later, because I went with my wife's family, and they got two, you know, 8-year-old boys in the family, and they're going to their first game at Wrigley Field and all that. One of them ended up getting a ball, and fortunately, we didn't have any of that nonsense with the guy grabbing the ball who actually turned out to be grabbing the ball because he was giving it to another kid because he had already given a ball earlier that wasn't captured on camera to the kid that it looked like he was snubbing. So that's my advice here, is just remember when you see a video on Twitter that people are using to provoke some sort of outrage, consider that you may not have all the context. Cardinals beat the Cubs 6-3 with a 3-run ninth inning. 3 hours and 38 minutes that game took to play, and there wasn't even a rain delay. But Matt Carpenter of the Cardinals hit his 5th home run in 2 days. Now, this was the 3rd game that he would have played, but still very impressive to hit 5 home runs over a 2-day span in a single ballpark. The thing I like about Chicago is, even more so than New York, I walk down the street in Chicago and I want to eat at so many different places. And then what happens is I often just end up going to the same bars and same restaurants that I've gone to before that I can count on, like Peace Brewery and Pizzeria, the best pizza / brewery in the United States of America. I can't decide if I like the pizza better or the beer, like the Hefeweizen that they have there, that's just magnificent. You got the Map Room up towards Bucktown, which is the best nerd bar in America, simply because they have about 10,000 issues of National Geographic lying. Well, they're on the shelves in there. It's not like I go in there and read it. I just go in there and have a couple of German beers with my wife before we go meet her family over at Wrigley. Sort of a self-medicating sort of thing, because as families go, it can be a bit much sometimes, but we made it through. And as I said, thank God that there was no rain delay in that game, because it was raining off and on pretty much the entire time I was in Chicago. Had Italian beef a couple times, did dip and non-dip at Portillo's. I had it non-dip, and I forgot to get it with peppers, because I think I was just befuddled by how crowded it was there at like 1:30 in the afternoon on a Thursday. I was kind of, actually it was a Friday, but I was really kind of scratching my head on that. Not that it matters, but my deep dish of choice in Chicago is Lou Malnati's. Went there on Sunday for lunch. Make sure you get the butter crust that they offer for, I think it's 75 cents to a dollar more. Believe me, you will thank me later when you get that. And then I go to the airport, and I get there at 8:30 on Sunday night, and I notice the security line is out of control, and I say, well, thank God I have TSA pre-check. Well, no, apparently they close TSA pre-check at Chicago Midway Airport at 8:30 on Sunday. But luckily, when I get through the line, I got to be first among equals in that I got to be the one DB who didn't have to take his shoes or his belt off and just kind of, you know, hold up my boarding pass or whatever. So at least I got something out of that and allowed me through quick enough so I could go to the Chicago White Sox themed bar on the other side of security, which is pretty much the only evidence that the White Sox exist on that in the whole city of Chicago when I was there. Not so much with the Blackhawks either. It was kind of strange considering they've won 3 Stanley Cups in recent years and going to be playing in the Winter Classic this January against my Boston Bruins, which I will be attending in South Bend, Indiana. I've just decided to say, screw it, I'm going to make the trip out for that. I don't know what Indiana-themed episode I could do. What am I going to pull, some just sort of WWA or something from 1974? I don't know. I have a lot of time to figure that out. But as for this episode, I was completely undecided on it until I got on the plane Sunday night, which was a 10:05 flight getting into Boston at 1:20 a.m. local time, and I pulled into my garage at 2:30 in the morning. But I watched this entire episode on the plane. I mean, I had seen it before. It's something that's in my strategic reserve. It's not on YouTube right now, and as a matter of fact, it's not even on Daily Motion either. This used to be on YouTube about a year ago and was victimized by one of the random purges that they have. I'm not entirely sure what particular thing was at fault here. But ironically enough, the copy that I have is missing one match, and I could tell because the episode is only 41 or 42 minutes, and that happens to be an Ultimate Warrior match that ended up on a Coliseum video as sort of an early example of the Ultimate Warrior. I'm just going to touch on that match briefly when I get to the point in this show where it would have been. This Superstar is actually kind of a very relevant taping, and not just because we're in November and we are in the sweeps period, as I had mentioned a few weeks ago, where February and May and November are those years or those months where you see more of the feature matches. And here our feature match is Superstar Billy Graham versus the Natural Butch Reed, which doesn't sound like much, but it's more the angle than the match because it's going to have an impact on the upcoming Survivor Series, which is being promoted heavily with a interview with Andre the Giant's Survivor Series team that has some hijinks in it. It gets to be quite fun. And we also see their nemesis from that match at the Survivor Series, Bam Bam Bigelow, who eliminated 2 of the guys on Andre's team. He's in action on this show. And also a music video for Demolition, the Rick Derringer song off the Piledriver album, which was also released around this time. There's about a month to go before the Slammy Awards, so they were playing a lot of the music videos on the weekly TVs. I think we missed Stand Back by 1 week, but this is not Vince McMahon dancing. You don't get that until the Slammies. Also on this show, we're going to get one of the famous Ted DiBiase live-action vignettes. You know, the vignettes where he would go and buy out the public pool just to be a dink and get everybody kicked out, or buy his way in the emergency room. This was more on the interview platform, and this is one of the more famous ones where a little boy is asked to dribble a basketball 15 times for a sum of money. This taping was in Syracuse, New York, taped on October 27th, 1987. And I think I kind of got away from that for a sec. The most famous match on this taping was on the previous week's Superstars on November 7th, when Strikeforce defeated the Hart Foundation for the WWF Tag Team titles. And that will be touched on a little bit later in the show. Now, before we get into the show, which is a little heavy on the non-wrestling segments, a lot of promos, hyping the upcoming first Survivor Series. I want to say congratulations to friend of the show and co-host of the wrestling podcast About Nothing, Mike Crockett. Late last week, his wife gave birth to a baby boy.
And I hope that their first child be a masculine child.
Thank you very much, Luca Brazzi. And on the Our Vantage Point podcast, I don't think either one of them welcomed a child into the world in the past week, at least that we know of. Their show this week, they discussed 1991 WWF, so that's kind of like a baby of mine, I would think. If I had a son, like, I don't have any children right now, but if I did, it would probably be discussing 1991 WWF, just that abstract concept. All right, so now that I've aired all the laundry, I've hung it right out on the line, why don't we just dive right into the show? Also going on at placetobenation.com right now is the preliminary rounds of the greatest song of the 1980s tournament. And with so many songs to choose from being put into groups of 10 right now, and you will vote for five. And you'll see me stuffing the ballot box for Steve Winwood, the Gap Band, Huey Lewis, although I don't think Huey Lewis really needs my help. I think Winwood and Gap Band might. But Steve Winwood's Valerie, one thing to connect that back to wrestling, that little note at the end of the clip I played sounds an awful lot like the note at the end of the Superstars of Wrestling theme. I'm not a musician, but they sound alike to me, or at least very similar to each other. Steve Winwood's song, I think, would have come first. So we get our intro to Superstars, and instead of Vince telling us about all the great things that Syracuse, New York has to offer, such as snow 6 months out of the year, Marine beating up Shawn Michaels, that's not going to be for another few years. Instead, we get to hear from a gentleman by the name of Norman Rothschild. And these are good, too, when they would have the random dude who was like the facilities manager of the Oakland Coliseum go on there. The all-time greatest was the guy in Nashville who was named Bill Boner just because his name was Boner. And then eventually he stepped out on his wife, like multiple wives, and his boner got him in trouble. But anyway, this Norman Rothschild character is a former, well, he was a boxing promoter dating to the 1950s in the Syracuse area, based on the research that I was able to pull up. And he looks an awful lot like Abe Vigoda, but you think, okay, so he's a boxing promoter, he's probably skilled in the art of communication. Well, not really, because he kind of sounds like a hostage.
My 35 years in the facilities industry, the World Wrestling Federation has consistently provided the best promotion and the best family entertainment we've ever had.
I heartily endorse this event or product.
I'm not sure what's crazier, the fact that Norman wasn't holding up a copy of that day's newspaper as if he was a hostage, or the fact that he's actually still alive. He's in his 90s. I was going to play the alive or dead game, and I was shocked to see that he's alive, and his wife of, I think it said 60 years, only passed away 2 years ago. So good on him. Bruno is still on commentary with Jesse and Vince, and we see them, and Vince and Bruno look adorable in the matching red jackets. Jesse's wearing his own thing, as he is wont to do. And Vince doesn't say anything really funny, except for one choice of words that is certainly associated with him at the end of 1987.
We'll have action for you, all kinds of it. Stand back, here we go.
Stand back! Stand back! Stand back!
That happened, and we all let it happen.
Yes, that is very true. But for our first match, we have Bam Bam Bigelow, who's got the big push after coming in, spurning all heel managers, taking on Gino Carabello. And Bam Bam had that awesome music for his babyface run in 87 and 88. And a lot of people wonder why he would have music that was basically jazzy saxophone stuff. Now, I would play it underneath this, except there's virtually no clean copy of that anywhere. You would think it would have been on the Piledriver album, but it's not. And that it might have been released on something down the line. But don't forget, Bam Bam leaves in the middle of 1988, so there's really no use for it until it was revived for 1991's primetime wrestling with the studio audience and all that. But maybe jazz makes sense for Bam Bam. I mean, we don't know everything about him that we could. I mean, he's not going to reveal everything in shoot interviews over time. I think that if I had been able to do a shoot interview with him before he passed, I could have asked him questions like, did you have some sort of greater interest in jazz music? You're from Asbury Park. There are places on the boardwalk. The first one that comes to mind is the Stone Pony, but that's more of a rock kind of place. But they have a jazz festival there every August. So maybe Bam Bam was just into that sort of scene and into that thing. And maybe that's why he didn't see eye to eye with the boys in the back who were more maybe into country or rock or whatever, and he's into jazz, so he's just kind of an outlier. Just because he tattooed his entire head with flames and wears an entire bodysuit with flames on it, don't judge a book by its cover, okay? This guy can like Miles Davis as much as the next person. But Jesse Ventura's problem with Bigelow is something different.
His athletic prowess is fantastic. My only problem with this Bigelow is, you know what that is?
What?
Looking at him.
Look at that maneuver.
He's not exactly a sight for sore eyes, you know.
I thought Jesse was going to go after Oliver Humperdinck, considering that he's even weirder looking than Bigelow. And that's kind of like a phenomenon you often see with women in groups where one person may want to hang out with someone who is clearly less good-looking than them in order to make themselves look better by comparison, standing side by side. Maybe Bigelow, with his own, perhaps, insecurities, I know I'm just psychoanalyzing him from afar, and he's been dead for 10 years, maybe he chose Humperdinck because if he's out on the road or whatever, Humperdinck is ugly enough that Bigelow looks really attractive by comparison, despite all the weird tattoos and all that sort of stuff. He goes right to work, vertical suplex, falling headbutt. As I said, the push was on for this guy in late 87, and he had that nice little run in the Survivor Series match. After Hulk Hogan gets counted out, and it's 3-on-1, you think that the crowd is going to be completely dead, because Hogan is gone, sort of like what we saw later at the 1989 Royal Rumble, when Hogan gets eliminated and the crowd just sort of dies for the rest of the match. Didn't really happen at that Survivor Series. As Bigelow's going 1-on-3, he eliminates the one-man gang, he eliminates King Kong Bundy before falling to the closer, Andre the Giant. Vince mentions the latest WWF magazine that says that Bigelow is making too many enemies because of the whole manager thing by not choosing Slick or Jimmy Hart or Bobby Heenan. It now leaves it open where he can feud with any of those guys' proteges, which is nice because it'll certainly give him something to do and a reason for it. He would mostly end up feuding with Slick's guys and, oddly enough, teaming with Hogan against DiBiase and Andre. So as the friend of Hogan in the beginning of 88, things were looking really, really good for him. But of course, it would not turn out that way, in part because of some backstage issues, but also because he did hurt his knee and did not take really the necessary time off, or at least back then, he wasn't going to be allowed to. Carabello actually gets in a little bit of offense, but then Bam Bam shakes it off, and to just show what kind of an athlete he was before his legs eventually betrayed him, you know, owing to the fact that he's near 400 pounds. He executes a standing drop kick, and this is not like the Jerry Blackwell one, which is at waist level. He gets up neck level on. It's really just an astounding thing to see. A gut-wrench suplex sets up the slingshot splash from the apron into the ring, which allows him to pick up the win. And Bam Bam was really awesome. The crowd was so into him in late 87, and I think it gets lost in part because of how it ended in 1988, and also because his later run is much more famous. The doink stuff at WrestleMania 10, and obviously the match with Lawrence Taylor at WrestleMania 11, for which Bam Bam, I'm not sure he gets enough credit for that. I'll talk about that another time when, you know, I discuss him and that run. But why did he have to... first of all, why did he have to be a dink backstage, by all accounts? And secondly, why does Oliver Humperdink have to be there? Is this a case of too much too soon? As per Tony Atlas, it may well have been.
Well, let me show you a little something. I happen to have a nice little toy here. It's the brand new Hulk Hogan stretch doll.
That is Bobby Heenan on the interview platform with Andre the Giant's team that they were not naming the Survivor Series teams until 1989. But this one, somewhere along the line, and I don't know what show it was, it was referred to as One Ton of Determination, which I love as a team name because it also happened to be accurate as well, or more or less accurate. You got Andre at 520, One Man Gang I put down at 457, Bundy 460, Reed 275, and Rude, wasn't sure, so I just put down 235 because he's smaller than the rest of them. That brings a total combined weight of 1,947 pounds, so very close to a full ton, nearly averaging 400 pounds per man. I mean, you get three of them over the 400-pound mark. And Bobby Heenan is talking about the LJN stretch wrestlers that were made available in the middle of 1987, and those suckers are pretty rare nowadays, at least judging by some of the asking prices on eBay. The Randy Savage one person is asking $350, or at least that's what the minimum bid is on that right now. Junkyard Dog is somewhere in the mid-100s. They only made 8 different ones, including a Roddy Piper one, which is kind of funny because he's off on hiatus by the time the figures get released, but he was popular enough leading up to that that you would have had to include him. I'm just kind of trying to remember, because I don't remember seeing these in stores. The time I started watching in 1988, they might have been gone because they would break, apparently, very easily. So I was kind of on these wrestling figurine forums, and there was one comment that I found particularly humorous by somebody named Stom, W-I-J-F. I don't even know how to pronounce that. I have a full set of these. I dare not stretch them as they are over 20 years old, and I am pretty sure stretching them will lead to disaster. They are pretty fragile and have white powder inside of them, which, oh my God, that is very realistic if there was white powder inside of them for 1980s wrestler figurines, especially the Piper doll and the Junkyard Dog one. But Heenan, in this case, took the Hulk Hogan stretch doll, basically the Stretch Armstrong concept, with the exception being Stretch Armstrong had like that petroleum goo that would be in it, kind of the same stuff that you, when you get a mouse pad that has the little pad for your wrist. I have one of those at work. I decided to use my own mouse pad because, as I said last week, I'm a fancy boy, so I have my own mouse and mouse pad at work. And the four of the guys on the team grab the Hogan stretch doll by an extremity.
Shouldn't you do something with the extremities?
What extremities?
What's an extremity?
Finally, Andre grabs the head. He's just kind of standing in back and grabs the head and breaks it apart as Craig DeGeorge, who is conducting this interview, says that they're not showing very much respect for the heavyweight champ, to which Slick says that it is the congregation of sophistication, as only Slick would put it. And then Heenan quickly closes out. Just a little hype job for the match, which is important because, not because it's pay-per-view and we're going to take apart Jim Crockett Promotions before they even get a chance to go on pay-per-view. It's that Hogan and Andre had not shared a ring since WrestleMania 3 because Andre is out recuperating, with the original thought being that WrestleMania 3 could possibly be his last match, which for them would have been a bad thing because you have to do the rematch somewhere down the line, especially if you're going to do the near 3 count at the beginning, and you're not just going to have Hogan go out there and squash him because you want to leave the possibility of the rematch open. And they don't even meet one-on-one until the following February. So I think they deserve credit for just holding it back as long as possible. However, it's a lot of that is owed to Andre's just deteriorating physical state, which kind of weird when you think about him into 1988. He starts wrestling a lot more, a fairly regular schedule compared to the previous couple of years when you would only see him very infrequently. But he's working what is nearly a full house show schedule in 1988 and into 89. And as the interview ends and they go into commercial, they play the ominous guy announcing the Survivor Series on Thanksgiving night. As I said a few episodes ago, I'm convinced that that was how they announced it to Jim Crockett. I think they left a message on Crockett's voicemail just played the audio of that. In fact, I'm pretty sure that it would have sounded something like this.
I'm so sorry, you have just reached my answering machine. I'm not in at present, I'm sure you know this whole routine. Leave your name and number, and I'll try to get back to you. You have 30 seconds to talk to me before you're through.
Thanksgiving night. Witness the Survivor Series.
I know that's a bit that I'm doing, but I wouldn't be shocked one iota if that is actually how it went down. Because you'd say, well, even with Rupert Holmes doing the voicemail at Jim Crockett Promotions, yes, I could see with the way that they were wasting money all through 1987, them bringing in Rupert Holmes to record a voicemail message for them on their answering machine when really they could have just done it themselves. I could just see Jim Crockett and Dusty flushing away money doing something like that instead of just having the secretary read off whatever, or like a normal person would do it. And I could certainly see Vince trying to screw with them like that.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Get a little video for Brutus the Barber Beefcake, whose gimmick started at WrestleMania 3 with the Piper versus Adrian Adonis match, and then he got sidetracked because Adrian Adonis got himself fired shortly thereafter, so he was left without a feud for much of 1987, and basically having matches with Johnny V, where he would take off a little bit of hair at a time, because you couldn't just shave his head all at once. Instead, you just take bits and pieces, and his house show schedule is rather interesting for that year. He really bounces around in the middle of the year before finally settling into the Greg Valentine feud, which should have come after WrestleMania 3 anyway, but he was stuck in the new Dream Team with Dino Bravo. A lot of haircuts in this video, but also the spraying of the B for Beefcake, as they said. It was not B for Brutus or B for Barber or B for Boston Bruins. As I said, Brutus Beefcake, Ed Leslie, is a Boston Bruins fan, and I have seen him at a number of different home games, and I've also seen him at the airport when I was traveling to, oddly enough, Chicago for a Bruins game in 2011, and I'm pretty sure he was not booked on some indie show there. I know I had said this on the Place to Be podcast recently, but it took a little while for the Brutus Beefcake thing to get going, and I think it was actually good for him because it allowed him to develop his in-ring work in 87 and into 88. And then you get to 1989 and he actually becomes somewhat good and is in the main event, which people have some issues with that, but it pays to be a friend of Hulk Hogan. And into our next match, we have the Bolsheviks with their capitalist pimp manager, Slick, taking on Jerry Allen and Mario Mancini. Now, Mario Mancini has a really cool jacket here that just says Mario Mancini on the back. And I'm wondering, why is that not shown up on the auction market? Is there a... I might be interested in buying that just to have to wear to shows in the winter, because that would be a definite conversation piece. And Mario Mancini actually picked up a win over Gino Carabello in 1985. I was rather interested in that, because Carabello, I don't think I mentioned in the first match, has a cage match record of 1-61. And I love those guys who only have the one win, which, by the way, was over Jim Powers, of all people. His tag partner, Jerry Allen, is the answer to a trivia question that I almost certainly can't put in the Place to Be 500 trivia contest. He was the first guy to pick up a win over Ravishing Rick Rude, per the results at thehistoryofwwe.com, shortly after the Ravishing One made his way in from Jim Crockett Promotions. It was on a house show, not televised. I don't even think it was filmed or anything like that. So, as I said, the Bolsheviks with their capitalist pimp manager. And it made me wonder about Slick's political views. And he does have a burgundy hat on, so, you know, he's leaning red, I guess. And why would this man associate himself with the communists like this? It seems like kind of an odd fit. And I think it's perfectly obvious that Slick wants to make inroads into the Soviet Union, perhaps in illegal prostitution trade, which, you know, you do what you can to survive. But with the markets in the Soviet Union starting to open with Perestroika and Glasnost, he saw an opportunity and associated himself with these two men. He only gets with Volkov when he buys the contracts of Blassie's guys. That was about a year before this. And Volkov sings the anthem, but it's not as cool as the Maple Leaf Wrestling episode, in episode 54 of Greetings from Allentown, where the crowd shouts the Canadian national anthem over it. That's one of my favorite moments that I've covered on this show, because that was a real hidden gem. Jesse says he's standing for the singing rather than some sort of admiration for the Soviet Union. So you wonder, when did Boris Zhukov come in and rescue Nikolai Volkov from toiling as a pure jobber, which is pretty much what he was doing for much of the summer? JYD, you know, other guys, George Steele versus Nikolai Volkov matches, that's really not going to fly at that point in time. So you need to put Nikolai in a tag team, maybe with another guy who could eat the fall, maybe a smaller sort of guy. So they bring in Volkov, who was one half of the AWA Tag Team Champions, and he leaves with the belt, although I guess he returned it, because apparently he's a nice guy, to replace the Iron Sheik, who had famously been fired in May for getting caught on the New Jersey Turnpike with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and a little bit of drugs, that white powder that you would find, maybe not the same white powder that you would find in the stretch figures, but I'm thinking of the Bolsheviks in terms of the greatest tag team ever, the GWWE for Place to Be Nation, and just wondering if I can even rank them in the top 100 because they never really sniffed much of the success that pretty much every other team. You can at least point to something with, you know, other tag team. Even the Killer Bees had their moments. There's nothing with the Bolsheviks other than maybe a handful of promos on Saturday Night Main Event that Slick is responsible for, but neither of the two guys, Volkov and Zukov, really did anything memorable other than provoke some of the jokes about the size of Zukov's head. And Volkov, he works over Jerry Allen early, and as this is going on, we get a promo read from Howard Finkel in the voiceover for a show coming to my area.
Another outstanding World Wrestling Federation event will be headed to the Centrum in Worcester 1 week from this Monday night on the 23rd of November. And a great array of stars are headed to town, including King Kong Bundy, the Polish power Ivan Putski, the tag team of the British Bulldogs, in addition to the Honky Tonk Man. These great stars and more in Worcester at the Centrum 1 week from this Monday night, November 23rd.
Now, I know what you're thinking. Ivan Putski being promoted in 1987, how bad was that show? Well, he did a job in the opening match for Ron Bass, so things weren't all bad. And the top four matches made this not a bad show, as it turns out. Ted DiBiase pinned Coco Beware. The WWF Women's Tag Team Champions, Judy Martin and Leilani Kai, the Glamour Girls, pinned the Jumping Bomb Angels, or defeated the Jumping Bomb Angels. Jim Duggan pinned King Harley Race, and the main event, the Macho Man Randy Savage and the British Bulldogs defeated the Honky Tonk Man and the Hart Foundation when Savage pinned Neidhart. So not bad when you get to those. I mean, that might be one of those deals where you want to show up late to the show and do that. Eventually, Mario Mancini gets in here, and I love me some Mario Mancini. However, he's wearing red trunks against the Bolsheviks, and it kind of makes me wonder, is this guy taking a dive for communism? I think he should be called in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee or the House Un-American Enhancement Activities Committee, because I feel like he should wear blue or any other color other than red facing these commies. Now, Zukov is relatively new in the WWF, as I had said, so I like to look for historic moments in time, and this right here from Jesse Ventura might be the first crack about the size of Boris Zukov's head.
You know what gets me about Zukov? If you looked at the size of that man's head, I mean, his head's the size of two heads.
Now that you mention it, oh my.
There ain't nothing like when Vince and Jesse are playing off each other like that. Backbreaker by Nikolai, and then he makes the tag to Zukov, who off an Irish whip. Zukov runs the ropes himself for some momentum, and helmet-to-helmet, or head-to-head contact in this case. Be a 15-yard penalty in the NFL in today's world, not probably in 1987. And that is how they pick up the win. I recall the Bolsheviks developing a different finisher, where Volkov would have a guy up in the Argentine backbreaker position and Zukov would come off with a forearm. You don't really see them win that often anyway, but that's the one that I actually remember. And the Bolsheviks pick up a win here. However, I'm not sure that this victory, this great victory over Mario Mancini and Jerry Allen, is going to be quite enough to get them in my top 100 greatest WWE tag teams ever.
Hi again, everyone. We are coming back to Beantown.
As you may know, nobody who's from Boston actually calls it Beantown, and it seems that the name Beantown originated with merchants and sailors dating all the way back to the 16 and 1700s, which I suppose means that the only person who can actually call it Beantown is Tugboat, and he's not around at this point. So Craig DeGeorge, this is a promo for the upcoming show at the Boston Garden on December 12th, which would air on NESN 3 days later. They would not televise the Boston Garden shows live on the New England Sports Network. They started up 1985, the last show aired 1989. A Saturday house show would generally air on NESN on Wednesday night, and I actually have the promo for this show on my YouTube channel.
It's the season to get your
your jollies when Nesson presents the WWF from Boston Garden, Tuesday, December 15th at 8 p.m. See the man-to-man rematch between Randy Savage and the Honky Tonk Man. The Earth moves when King Kong takes on Bam Bam. Jake the Snake puts the moves on Killer Khan. Brutus Beefcake messes with the one-man gang, plus much, much more. So hang your stocking and put out the mistletoe. The WWF is coming to town, Tuesday, December 15th at 8, only on Nesson.
Sorry, I really need to stop recording that audio while running the vacuum cleaner in the background. I try my best to get rid of that stuff, but mainly I play that because of the WWF on Nesson theme, which if I ever went to a permanent theme for Greetings from Allentown, I would just use that one because it's so damn cool. So they welcome in Jimmy Hart, who is going to be suspended in a cage above the ring for the Honky Tonk Man versus Randy Savage Intercontinental title match. And Jimmy makes a very interesting point.
You're going to be some 50 feet suspended in a cage above the ring, and that, of course, will prevent you from any interference. Let's put it that way.
You know, why don't you get that big smile off your face? You're like all the people in the audience. It's not going to be 50 feet. It's going to be more like 500 feet above the ring. This is very dangerous for me. That little bitty rope that holds that cage, when they hoist me up, if that thing was to fall, I could be seriously injured.
Hey, Jimmy, don't worry about it. This is the World Wrestling Federation. They would never be so negligent to allow a guy named Hart to fall from the ceiling and, you know, get injured or die in the ring. Anyway, Honky Tonk Man says his piece here, and this one was rather interesting because I remembered the involvement of Peggy Sue one way, but it was actually presented slightly differently.
When a Honky Tonk Man gets to Boston Garden, when I'm there and I'm looking up there at all the signs, I think about the greatest basketball player that plays there of all time. I'm talking about Larry Bird. And when you think about professional wrestling, you think about the greatest intercontinental heavyweight champion of all time, you're thinking about the Honky Tonk Man. And I've got something for Boston Garden. I've got something for you, Jimmy Hart. I've got something for you, Randy Savage. And you, Elizabeth, I've got the greatest girlfriend in the world. That's right, Peggy Sue. My girlfriend Peggy Sue will be at ringside with a Honky Tonk Man. Yes,
wait,
sir.
Whoa, wait a minute. Hold on a second. According to what I have seen, anyway, Peggy Sue has what color hair?
Blonde hair and blue eyes.
I thought I saw some pictures. I thought the person who will be ringside was a brunette. And of course, I'm referring to I'm referring to Sensational Sherry, who is not just a girlfriend.
She is
no,
not
she's the world
be there.
Champion.
It's going to be Peggy Sue, my girlfriend, because she is the only one I can trust now with Jimmy Hart suspended 500 feet above ringside. It's not any Sherry Martell. It's not a brunette.
Well, first thing is, I think that Honky is selling Bill Russell a little bit short. I mean, 11 titles in 13 years. But to be fair, Larry Bird was coming off one of his all-time greatest performances, just the Saturday before this aired on November 7th, where he hit four last-minute game-winning shots against the Washington Bullets. To put it that way, it was a double overtime game. One of them actually didn't count because the Celtics had called timeout. It's a pretty crazy performance, and I'll probably put that in the footnotes of the show. But mainly, it's that Peggy Sue being openly revealed to be Sensational Sherry. When you get into 1988, there's really no references made to that. Peggy Sue's at WrestleMania 4, who revives Honky. By the way, she doesn't save Jimmy Hart from getting his hair cut. Good on her to at least, you know, save her man, the Honky Tonk Man, but she really didn't do a whole lot for Jimmy Hart in that one. But there's no real reference to her being Sensational Sherry. And it's good that at least they were giving Sherry something to do other than having her in the same matches against the same people, because there was no commitment to any sort of women's division. Yeah, you're going to have Rockin' Robin and Sensational Sherry. Later in 1988, they'll do a title change, and Sherry holds the title for a while. She wins it in July of 87, holds it, I believe, to like October or November of 1988, so a pretty long title reign, and you didn't see her much on television, not a lot of title defenses, but she still was there a lot more often than than Brock Lesnar ever has been. And this is nearing the end of the Die Honky Die with Randy Savage, where the people were just crazy for the Macho Man, in at least towards the end of 1987 and into 88. Because once you get to WrestleMania 4 and you get to those final months of the Honky Tonk Man's title reign, it just sort of feels like killing time in a way. I don't know if it was to make him the longest reigning champion, because he did not pass Randy Savage by very much. It was only a couple of weeks that he has the longest title reign. But he's one hell of a promo, and he was on a roll in 1987. And I wrote an article on it. I wrote 10 articles on my website, section309.com. At some point, maybe I'll repurpose them for something else, or maybe expand upon them, where I wrote an article on the Honky Tonk Man in 1987 and why he was the ideal choice to be headlining these B shows as the Intercontinental Champion.
Just in case you missed it last week, here, ladies and gentlemen, footage from the tag team title matchup. It was Strike Force against the Hart Foundation. Here's the last few moments of the matchup.
As I said in the intro, this is the same taping as the Strike Force title win over the Hart Foundation. And this match, in a vacuum, it's got a really odd finish when you just look at it. Because on the footage, you show Martel hitting Neidhart in the gut. Bret Hart is nowhere to be seen around ringside. He's not up on the apron, and you don't see much of Jimmy Hart. Tito comes in, and they help each other slam Neidhart down. Tito gets escorted out, so a mild illegal double team, but he gets out at the count of five, even though there was no tag. Martel locks in the Boston Crab, and you're waiting for Bret to come in the ring and break this up, or Jimmy to do something for the DQ. Instead, Neidhart submits after a couple of seconds in the Boston Crab. It's really, really weird to sort of see a title change go down that way with a 100% clean submission in spite of the double team, which is what Jesse complains about. Strike Force is a team that certainly will be ranked in my top 100. Interesting how to sort of handle both the Can-Am Connection and Strike Force, because they seem like two sides of the same coin. I do think it was an upgrade to have Tito there in place of Tom Zenk, but also, if you're going for the heartthrob tag team, Tito Santana, maybe not the best fit, because he's more of just kind of a classic wrestler rather than what Tom Zenk was, you know, the more good-looking guy for the ladies. And this is a classic case of, with the chase being over for Strikeforce, now they're on top, and things just aren't the same for them once they become champions. And I think a small, itty-bitty part of that is the girls in cars thing, because when it comes to, you know, the songs off Pile Driver. Yeah, Girls in Cars, okay, that's, you know, it's a nice little ditty or whatever, but the guys in the crowd, I don't know if they could really get behind the two dudes doing, you know, a music video like that, or coming to the ring to that song. Not really much of it, and that really stands out with the Demolition match at WrestleMania 4. So really, I'm not saying that they should have never gotten the tag titles. I think that it should have been a much shorter transitional reign, but I gotta hold it out to WrestleMania. Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies. Tell me lies. Oh no, no, you can't disguise. Little Lies by Fleetwood Mac was at number 4 on the American Top 40. This date in 1987. And there were some lies told about our next competitor, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. Trying to find new takes to talk about Orndorff is becoming rather difficult. But as we all probably remember, or at least those of us who are old enough to have lived, you know, in the late 80s, there was the rumor that Mr. Wonderful had died in 1988 because he just disappeared off the scene. But as Orndorff told Pro Wrestling Illustrated, rumors of my demise, rumors of my death, have been greatly exaggerated, quoting the author Mark Twain. In fact, he just went back to manage his bowling alley in Georgia, which seems like a nice enough thing to do. He's taking on Carmine Saras, who is from Mount Kisco, New York. Now, don't be fooled when you drive down I-684 and you get to that Mount Kisco exit and you see the sign saying, Burger King, this exit. It's like 6 miles away. So don't be fooled by any of that. If you think you're just going to pull off the exit ramp and get a Whopper and, you know, be on your way 3 minutes later, you're sadly mistaken. Orndorff is now managed by Oliver Humperdinck and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Way too much Humperdinck on this show for my tastes. And Humperdinck only really became Orndorff's manager so that he could be established as somebody who was in the WWF before he could become Bam Bam Bigelow's manager. It would not have made a lot of sense for Bam Bam to just choose a manager that nobody would have heard of. So 1 week, Orndorff has him as the manager, and then the following week, Bam Bam decides to join up with Humperdinck, for better or worse, mostly worse. And this is the power of Bobby Heenan. Just simply the fact that Orndorff could fire him for a second time, and all of a sudden now, we're back to the 1985-86 Paul Orndorff, where he's magically over as a babyface. I don't quite get it, but Orndorff was just had this ability to get himself over to a solid level no matter what, you know, what he was. I mean, he's certainly fading out of the picture, sort of like how his arm was shriveling up and was now at this point noticeably smaller than the other arm because he didn't get any surgery done because he was in the program with Hulk Hogan and making a lot of money for himself. And just thinking of Orndorff and how he seemed to turn babyface or heel, he was kind of on the one turn per year program. So I like to think of Mr. Wonderful, at least WWF Orndorff, and Lex Luger, and then later WWE version of Big Show as all one person, in that Orndorff comes in as a heel end of 83 and then, you know, all through 84. Turns babyface 85. 86, heel turn on Hogan. 87, turns babyface again because he fires Heenan. Now you get to Lex Luger, who was in the Horsemen in 87. And around that 87, 88, around the same time that Orndorff disappears from the scene, Luger turns babyface, then turns heel in 1989, turns babyface again in 1990, turns heel in 1991, then he kind of disappears to do the WBF, has the injury thing, so I guess he's a heel through 92. Babyface in 93 with the Stars and Stripes, USS Intrepid nonsense, and then you get a couple of years, so you get a nice little All-American run by Lex Luger. Then he becomes a heel in 95 at Halloween Havoc, joining up with the Dungeon of Doom. Then back to a babyface in 1996 to oppose the NWO, which he stays right through 97, and then things kind of get fussy. It's at that point that he may have turned it over to the Big Show, who was known as the Giant at that point in WCW. So kind of a gray area. So I like to think of just those three guys as being one person who just would turn every 12 to 15 months, whether they needed to or not. A back suplex by Orndorff in this match. And that's to let All Japan Pro Wrestling that he's open for business. It was a Saito suplex. Rest in peace, Masa Saito, who passed away recently. And I wonder, did Orndorff ever work Japan? Well, he never worked All Japan Pro Wrestling, but he did work in New Japan for a little stint in 1980, and then in 1983, he worked much of the year doing at least three different tours of New Japan, so he does have experience over there. And Jesse, finally, after he didn't do it in the Bam Bam match, he finally takes his shot at Oliver Humperdinck, so I don't have to.
You're telling me that little fat, red-headed troll outside the ring's going to take you to a championship, Humperdinck?
You don't think so?
I have a tough time distinguishing who's uglier, Humperdinck or Bam Bam Bigelow.
To me, I think the best version of Oliver Humperdinck is the guy who owned the auto parts store in the movie Roadhouse, Red, who... actor's name is Red West, and was actually part of the Memphis Mafia with Elvis Presley back in the day. That's the best case scenario for Oliver Humperdinck, and instead we get him managing the Freebirds, as I covered last week. Going forward, after some time off, he disappears for a while, to my recollection, thank God. He might have gone down to Florida with Dusty for that promotion that he had in early 1989. Jesse gets all indignant about Orndorff, talking about his mental state, but also when Orndorff throws Carmine to the floor and then goes out to the floor and chucks him back in. He's like, why is he throwing him out to the floor and then helping him back in? And Jesse was really harping on that point, to which I would say, well, you give yourself a little bit of a rest by doing that, and you want to, you know, throw him back in so you can get a pinfall. I mean, we're not all the berserker. A count-out victory is worth less in the minds of anybody watching versus hitting your finisher and pinning the guy cleanly in the center. Dropkick by Orndorff as Jesse continues his tirade. And they're still sparring over this, the commentary team. And the pile driver connects for Orndorff, because he could always deliver that quite well. Despite, as I said, the arm shrinkage from the nerve damage that he had was, dare I say, significant at this point.
Significant shrinkage.
So you feel you were shortchanged?
Yes.
Moving right along, we get a promo with part of the Honky Tonk Man's team for the Survivor Series. This is before you'd get the really fun group promos like we've seen for the 91 Survivor Series, or have done a couple of episodes of Superstars in the lead up to that show. Here we have the Honky Tonk Man, Outlaw Ron Bass, and Dangerous Danny Davis. And the one thing that stands out here is you can see the sweet, sweet Ringer t-shirts that they had for the first two Survivor Series shows, which you can get online. A couple of them are on eBay, one for $87 and one for $88. Unfortunately, the ask price is $150, and I ain't paying that much for a t-shirt that is 30 years old. There's an item on the WWE shop site that refers to itself as a Survivor Series established 1987 tee, but it's taking the logo that was there from 89 to 92 and using that rather than the 87-88. So it was kind of misleading. And also, it's on sale for $3.99, which isn't going to work. That's my memo to WWE. I know that there are collectors out there that this would probably harm in terms of their resale or whatever, but they could make bank selling just retro t-shirts of stuff from the mid-80s all the way up to, you know, the mid-90s or whatever. I know Pro Wrestling Tees has certain stuff where they have deals with, like, you know, Roddy Piper. I actually bought that one shortly after Piper passed. The Panther, the Rowdy Panther one that he wore to the ring for WrestleMania 1. But back to Honky and his team here. He announces, and this is something that really makes me question Honky Tonk Man's decision-making abilities, maybe all cognitive function. He's decided to make Danny Davis, Dangerous Danny freaking Davis, an honorary captain of his team.
All right. I just made Danny Davis honorary team captain, and he's assured me honorary that Outlaw Ron Bass will be ready with Miss Betsy, a 20-foot-long piece of leather, and there's going to be some leather popping.
As if it isn't bad enough that Davis has been named an honorary captain, they actually let him speak.
I have made a promise to the Honky Tonk Man, the Intercontinental Champion, the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time, that we are going to eliminate Savage, Steamboat, Beefcake, Duggan, and Snake.
Not only does Davis kind of look like Peter North's annoying older brother, but also he sounds drunk. There, he's kind of slurring his speech. He's billed from Dover, New Hampshire, but that doesn't sound like any sort of seacoast dialect that's coming out of his mouth. I think he's had too much to drink. Ugh. The fact that they let him talk under those circumstances is a demerit to both the Honky Tonk Man and Jimmy Hart, and maybe the promotion in general. Ron Bass just kind of acts mean by, you know, throwing the whip around and all that. He's very peculiar because he's a heel who doesn't have a manager in 1987 WWF, which was kind of unusual. And he, kind of like Beefcake, was victimized by an opponent or a rival and kind of dropping off the scene in the first half of 1987, as he was going to feud with Blackjack Mulligan, but he just kind of disappeared as he was wont to do, and Bass was left without a feud for much of the year, and he just kind of floundered and didn't really have much of a program until having a little brouhaha with Junkyard Dog shortly after WrestleMania 4. And they put up the cable systems to call, and since this is the Boston area, this is to call for the 1987 Survivor Series. I'm fascinated. I'm looking for any, you know, either where I grew up or where I live now on there. Seems to be more of a focus of south suburbs of Boston, but there are some noticeable spelling errors that are driving me insane. So this is not something that's limited to the NWA or the AWA. Somebody was really careless on the production here, and we're going to have a couple more production errors on the show. Abingdon, Mass? No, it's Abington, Mass. And Pembroke? No, it's Pembroke. Throwing in these extra R's. I know there's a R relocation program with the accent and the dialect, but this is just too much.
Let's take it out, ladies and gentlemen, the pre-recorded comments from Danny Davis.
No! God, please, no! No! No!
Just who does this guy think he is? Sam Houston. Drugstore cowboy. Facing dangerous Danny Davis on TV. And the officials giving him the match. Well, let me tell you something, son. Next time we meet, I'm going to teach you something you can't learn down on the ring.
I like wrestling, but I can't muster up the energy to care about the Danny Davis versus Sam Houston feud of late 1987. They had a match a couple weeks before on TV. Houston won via a roll-up, whatever. Sam Houston, not exactly the best name for a guy of that size. You say that, you expect a big Texan, not some dude who weighs 165 pounds. I just don't think that he ever had it. Yeah, he might have been a good enough worker in the ring, but he was just too damn skinny for me to really, you know, think that he was plausible against anybody in there. But the real problem here is, who the hell is airing two Danny Davis promos back-to-back? That is just poor form.
I don't like the idea of Milhouse having two spaghetti meals in one day.
I'll be honest, I think the only purpose of the second promo is to hear him talk normally to prove my point about him being drunk in the first promo.
Police Traditions, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceFanation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the PoliceFanation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, WorldCast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a vertical podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceFanation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceFanation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and ahistoryofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceFanation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, 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 a $1 million man is here. And as you can all see, I'm accompanied by my man, Virgil. And in one hand, Virgil has a basketball. Poor man's sport, basketball, right, Virgil? It's very easy to play basketball. All you need is a ball, a hoop, and an old raggedy pair of tennis shoes. Not like the expensive games that I play. They take Learjets, limousines, but that's another story.
For those who keep score of these things at home, DiBiase is wearing the black tuxedo with the purple trim. There was a bit of a problem early on with Ted DiBiase, and it was that it was a rich guy flaunting his money, and for that he wasn't necessarily going to get booed, because it's something in the American dream ingrained that we all want to aspire to be that rich guy pushing around others, for better or worse. So he was getting cheered in some places, and as a matter of fact, they actually show a woman holding up a poster board that had a dollar bill with Ted DiBiase's face on it. So I don't know if it was a greater commentary on whatever. And by the way, I'm not even going to touch Ted's social commentary on the game of basketball and it being a, quote, poor man's game. And I guess all you do need is a, you know, ball and hoop and shorts and all that and basketball shoes. So he switches over from the flaunting of his money to having fans do degrading stuff that we're very familiar with from the footage of Rob Van Dam kissing his feet. That woman who was not Linda McMahon, who looked like Linda McMahon down on all fours, barking like a dog. And this one here, a small child, probably about 7 to 9 years old, brought up on the interview platform and asked to dribble a basketball 15 times for $500. Now, little Sean, they had him dribble the ball 10 times first to just kind of demonstrate that he knows what he's doing when it comes to just something as simple as dribbling a basketball. So I think you all know how this ends.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Sean. If you can dribble this basketball 15 times consecutively without missing, look at here, I'm going to give you $500. Now, I know you and your family could use $500. I could tell by looking at you that you could use a lot more than $500.
Come to think of it, this actually reminds me of that putting hustle that I had when I was 7 years old out in front of the bar at Woburn Country Club, where some dude was paying me dollar bills to hit putts from 5 or 6 feet. I told this story several episodes ago, and then I ended up missing the big money putt for $5, where he threw it out 30 feet away from the hole and said, if you get it in two, I'll give you $5. So let's see how this kid does.
Virgil, give me the basketball. Okay, Sean, 15 times. Ready, go. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Oops! Oh! We didn't get to 15, Sean. You didn't get to 15, did you? No. He didn't make 15. And you know what that means? What that means, Sean, is you've got to learn a hard, cruel fact of life. When you don't do the job right, you don't get paid.
I know everybody is mad at DiBiase for what he did here, which is kicking the ball away when the kid got to 14. But please recall, he never said anything where I can't play defense against this. And second of all, the kid should know enough. Okay, he can dribble a basketball. That's fine. He may have played basketball with his friends. He should know enough from even watching on TV to maybe back Ted down, keep the ball away from him. Ball security. You could have learned that from watching Magic, Bird, basically any center in the NBA at that time, just ball security, and you wouldn't have had to rush through your dribbles the way it was. However, conversely, I will say the whole thing should have been nullified because an official would call a kick ball, and he should be allowed to do it again. If I may give you a peek behind the curtain the production of this show. As I was listening to that song and kind of preparing it, I'm watching on mute an episode of Primetime Wrestling that actually aired at the same time as the Survivor Series. Primetime was on Thursdays at that point, but then they moved it to Monday, actually, the following week, November 30th. So I'm listening to that song. Meanwhile, in the background, I am watching my man, Esty Jones, versus Frenchie Martin in a match taped in September of 87 at the Philadelphia Spectrum. In a match that goes 9:46. I'm listening to that song with that going on my TV, and it was quite hilarious. I recommend it to everybody. So you don't have to be high to have fun, quite frankly. But if, from the music perspective, we have the music video now for Demolition's theme, done by Rick Derringer, and you have to admit that it was the best song on the Piledriver album. However, I have to make this point right now. For those of you who complain that Demolition changed their theme song in 1990, it was because Axe was being phased out. You can't have a song that says, here comes the Axe, here comes the Smasher, we're Demolition, if Demolition is now Smash and Crush. And I'm sorry, you can't say here comes the Crusher because some old dude from Indiana or wherever he's from, Milwaukee, he's not going to come out and, you know, bolo punch somebody. So it's not the same thing. We get a little bit of an interview with Demolition to introduce this. Fuji is well in their camp for several months by this point. Even though Johnny V wraps up around Survivor Series, this change took place well in advance of that. And the face paint isn't quite down yet, particularly with Axe. He tried a lot of different designs. Smash's looks fairly close, like he's getting there, but it's not quite what we would become accustomed to. Kind of like Ron Bass and Brutus Beefcake earlier, Demolition, it took them a while to find an actual feud in 87. It's not like they were losing all the time or floundering, but at the end of 87, they're feuding with Billy Jack Haynes and Ken Patera because they had put out Brady Boone, who's the cousin in storyline of Billy Jack Haynes. But now they've got this cool song, and it's funny because earlier I talked about how having the song on Piledriver was detrimental to Strikeforce and coinciding with when they won the tag titles and how they seemed a little bit uncool being in that video. It's the exact opposite for Demolition because this song certainly enhanced them greatly, I think, going forward. And these two teams would collide at WrestleMania 4 and the torch would be passed to Demolition, who's getting babyface pomps from that otherwise comatose Atlantic City crowd. Right here, I'm going to do a breakdown of the song as the video plays. So as I mentioned, here comes the Axe, here comes the Smasher, the Demolition, Walking Disaster, which is kind of a funny lyric because you say Walking Disaster makes you think of some woman or man who doesn't have their stuff together, so to speak. But for this, it's because they rain destruction over everything that they, you know, are around. So, okay, there's that. Pain and Destruction are their middle names. Now, that sounds absurd when you think about it. Like, what is on their driver's licenses? What, Axe, Pain, Demolition? Smash, Destruction, Demolition? Are these their actual names? Sounds absurd. But, I mean, I've listened to the Adam Carolla show, and he said many times that his middle name, technically, because it's on his driver's license, is Adam Lakers Carolla, because he thought he had to write something in. So, there's nothing wrong with having an absurd middle name like the two members of Demolition have.
Destroy you, I'm trying to capture the spirit of the thing, right?
Well, you did.
Yeah, that's the money part of the song there. Search and destroy you, run and we'll find you. There's no place to hide, the demos will get you. Pain and Destruction are our middle names. I like how they abbreviate Demolition down to Demos, like it's a demo tape. But still, for some reason, it works, even though we're talking about men walking down in Road Warrior Mad Max outfits. Demolition, you better state your act of contrition. Some good stuff. Now, this is the part where you get the guitar solo that you don't get to hear as much. The one time you do get to hear it, and in fact you get it twice, is at the Survivor Series in 1988 when they, as the team captains, they come out to their theme. And because there's so many teams to introduce, you get to this back part of the song with the awesome guitar solo right here. This is the part right here. And then you hear it at the back end of the match as they're beating up Fuji on the outside of the ring after that bizarre turn. Your act of contrition. And from there, it's just sort of playing it out, repeating Demolition several times. There's some atom bombs that go off in the video and people reacting. So not Brian Clark, although people reacted the same way in general to Brian Clark matches. But they show them hitting their finisher three or four times. But back to that Survivor Series 88 thing where their theme plays after the match, even though they didn't win, the Powers of Pain were the survivors in the match. It's one of my favorite tropes in wrestling where the last person who runs in gets their theme song played. It's something that always makes me laugh, like, oh, they didn't win the match, but because Demolition came running out and cleared the ring afterwards, that means their theme should play, which I'm totally fine with if we're going to get that song out of it. But, like, how many times have you seen John Cena, like, do, like, a run-in, like, AA somebody, and then they play his theme, but, like, the match was, like, I don't know, Dolph Ziggler versus Bray Wyatt or some such nonsense.
Yeah, brother, it's not something you can just turn on and up, and it's knocking on your door. You can make it easy and you can open the door, or the Ultimate Warrior's gonna bust right through that door. What's he talking about? I'm talking about the power of the Warriors, and it's coming to the WWF!
So if you're wondering why I did not mention an Ultimate Warrior match earlier on, it's because on the copy of this Superstars that I have, the Warrior match is cut out. That's the promo that is pulled from YouTube from this episode. I mean, it's just a quick 2-minute squash against Steve Lombardi. It made it to one of the Ultimate Warrior DVD releases, so that's probably why it was cut out in the first place. And it is proof that he never made any sense from the word go. He had one match on Wrestling Challenge about 3 weeks before this, and he worked as the Dingo Warrior right up to when they taped that TV match, which was in the first week of October. Now, back to the stuff that is actually on the footage I have, Don Morocco taking on Dave Wagner. And this is really just sort of quick, almost like you're trying to establish that Don Morocco is there because he might be needed for something later. Morocco recently had turned babyface with the falling out with Bob Orton earlier in 1987. He's a natural heel, but he needed something new, I think, because he had been kind of the same guy and character for several years. And the team with Bob Orton by 87, and once you get past the opening match of WrestleMania 3, the team is just not really relevant anymore and nowhere even close to the tag team title picture. And just not even on the same level as the other heel teams. What's interesting about this match is some of the commentary, and I know I have not mentioned Bruno very much, but he does get more involved as this show goes along, such as here when Jesse engages Bruno on the topic of heavy metal music.
Before this match gets going, I want to ask Bruno, you like heavy metal music? You like that Demolition music?
Some of it I like, you know, some of it, not all of it.
We wouldn't hear Bruno lie like that until he appeared on that UWF broadcast, the Herb Abrams edition, and said, "This is the best wrestling in the world." Some big elbows by The Rock, Don Morocco, in sort of a half power slam, where not like a body slam and not quite like a power slam, so something in between. And Jesse refers to the thickness of The Rock. I don't think he's referring to what's between his legs, more like the arms and shoulders. And Morocco was starting to get a little bloated, although 1988, it got way worse from that perspective. Tombstone connects on Wagner for the quick victory here, and as I said, we're really just establishing that The Rock is in the building.
Here now, ladies and gentlemen, comments from some of the fans about ringside on what's going to happen Thursday night. That is Thanksgiving night during the Survivor Series.
There are some fans who had seen the elimination match concept from the WWF, because they had run several of them very early in the year, most notably at Madison Square Garden in February, which was Roddy Piper's last match in the building for several years. And it was him, Junkyard Dog, and Ricky Steamboat, which, what a team that is, facing Macho Man Randy Savage, Adrian Adonis, and King Harley Race. And that match is absolutely as good as it sounds, and you should seek it out on the YouTubes immediately. Now, the fans, these fan things, I kind of hope for at least the people who are coming out of No Holds Barred. I want that level of interaction with how they're going to react. And honestly, I'm really not disappointed with this crew.
Well, with the Survivor Series and the pay-per-view, I can treat my whole family to after Thanksgiving dinner excitement without my wallet taking a body slam.
Please tell me that's like the Miz's dad or his cousin or something, because it sounds like something Miz would say on one of those WWE Network specials where he just happens to say the thing that you would expect WWE to want somebody to say, sort of like a narrator, if you will. And that guy basically is very, very robotic in what he's doing. The next guy, not so much.
Oh, I'm telling you, Honky Tonk Mania is going to go nuts at the Survivor Series. Yeah, Honky
Tonk! No, that's not my dad. And to find a Honky Tonk Man fan in 1987 was quite an accomplishment, because like I said, most people were showing up to the event, live events to see the guy die. I should mention, I was kind of remiss on the first guy, just talking about how robotic he was. He was probably afraid of the person standing directly behind him, because he looked like Simon Gotch after about 51 rounds of growth hormone, because he had like the same mustache and the same eyes. It was kind of off-putting.
I've already called the pay-per-view Thanksgiving night. There is no better bargain. The whole family will be there watching the Survivor Series. You cannot beat it.
That guy was a little too professional. Again, I don't know where they found these people, but it reminds me of that time that I was working overnight and I called in to WROR here in Boston to answer a trivia question. And I think the prize was a DVD of Rod Stewart's Storytellers. I don't know why I was interested in winning that. I think my dad would have wanted that at that time. But anyway, I remember at the end, the guy asked me to do like the tag or whatever and say, "And what's your favorite station to listen to?" And I said, 105.7 WROR. And he's like, "Wow, you kind of sounded really professional with that." And I was like, "Yeah, I went to broadcasting school. I know what I'm doing." Time for the feature bout here on the Superstars of Wrestling, as the natural Butch Reed with Slick taking on superstar Billy Graham, the star of the first Greetings from Allentown, as he made his 1986 return, which lasted exactly one match before he went in for surgery. Surgery is then put on TV in June of 87, actually airing during Superstars and Challenge in one of the grossest things the WWF would ever do. He returns. He has a last hurrah sort of cage match shortly before this was taped at Madison Square Garden on October 16th, so 11 days before this would have been taped, in the building at MSG, where he reigned as the king in 1977 and 78 before losing the title in that very location to Bob Backlund in February of 78. Last hurrah. So a nice little gesture, I guess. But if you watch any Billy Graham match, hell, even watch the 1986 match, which is just really difficult to watch, where he can barely even do a bear hug. And he actually may have injured himself executing a bear hug, which that's a sign one of those signs that maybe things are breaking down for you? Kind of like my test a couple weeks ago of, if you can't outrun the junkyard dog, you should check yourself in somewhere to maybe get in some better shape. When the body goes, it just goes. And I'll just leave out any sort of steroid abuse. It's just the fact that the guy was finished. He could not move anymore. He could barely get up into the apron, into the ring. It's a tragic thing, I know, but he's in his mid-40s at this point. It's not like he's some young man. This is not some great tragedy like Bobby Orr being forced to retire at the age of 30 when he's the greatest hockey player who ever lived, at least to that point. I mean, I'm not going to entertain that whole debate or anything like that. Now, as for the natural Butch Reed, who, you know, he's feuding with Billy Graham to that point. And by the way, he was also a star in the first Greetings from Allentown, because that was his debut in the WWF. And you hear Jive Soul Bro as his theme music, which is very new, because, of course, that's on Piledriver. And I am actually grateful for the fact that the music video for Jive Soul Bro was not played on this show, and instead we got the Demolition one, because if I had to break down the Jive Soul Bro video, it would have taken me an hour and a half. I would have had to break that off into like a part two, like I was the lapsed fan or something, where I'd have to devote another 6 hours to, you know, why is Slick eating fried chicken at the beginning of it? What are they thinking with that? What's the story with that big woman that, you know, Slick is involved with? It's just the interplay between him and all the other people in the video. So there's that. Billy Graham, his music, Jesus Christ Superstar, which is a fantastic musical from the early 70s. It was something that I got to watch in CCD religion class when I was like 10 or 11 or 12 years old. It was after First Communion, but before confirmation, where you pretty much drop out of religion class at that point anyway. I was like, okay, we're done with you. One thing I miss from the 90s is when Jesus Christ Superstar would come around, because they were still touring. I liked when they would have those tours where they would say, now with the original Jesus, in which case they were referring to the actor Ted Neely. That he was in the movie from 1973. The original Broadway production was in 1970. And it was a good theme, I think. It fit Graham pretty well. Morocco, less so, but because Graham was there as his manager, I guess it sort of makes sense. And as I said, Graham has trouble even getting into the ring, and Reed attacks at the bell and starts choking Graham with his tie-dye shirt. And Jesse and Bruno have a nice little interplay here, which is good to hear, because Bruno doesn't speak up much, and to hear him, you know, interact with Jesse is always kind of fun. And they bicker about the tactics of Reed going after him right at the bell.
He didn't even let the superstar get into the ring before he nailed him.
Maybe he was afraid to. Maybe he figured if he gave him a fair chance, it might mean trouble for Reed, huh, Jesse?
That might be true, Bruno, but you do whatever works.
Ah, oh, baloney. This is disgusting. Let the man in the ring and be a man and start the match properly.
Butch Reed just hammering away.
You know, you're a fine one to talk about that, Bruno. I remember when you jumped Billy Graham the same way.
So me being the ultimate completist, I actually watched the beginning of 4 or 5 Billy Graham versus Bruno matches just to see if that ever happened. And no, Bruno never attacked Superstar at the bell, not even in their cage match in 1978, which was 2 days before Graham dropped the title to Bob Backlund. It's actually kind of covered in Bob Backlund's book, where he was afraid that Bruno and Graham were going to conspire to screw him out of the title, and Bruno was going to take the title. Of course, what he didn't realize is that Bruno didn't want the title, so I'm not entirely sure what Backlund was getting at there. He works the leg and the hip of the superstar, which Jesse, I don't rip Jesse very much for his commentary, because usually what he says makes sense, but he calls going after Graham's hip his Achilles heel. No, his Achilles heel is his Achilles heel. His hip is something that is certainly compromised because he had surgery on it. I know it's just an expression, but to refer to something as his Achilles heel when it's a completely different body part, Achilles heel should be talking about something in generalities, like, for example, in sports trivia, my Achilles heel is women's tennis. That is something that would make sense there when you're talking about non-body parts. The chair to the hip of Billy Graham. As he's outside of the ring, Graham is kind of almost to the apron, and Slick is distracting the referee this entire time, and Reed is really laying an ass-kicking on the superstar. And then, randomly, maybe to establish that he's watching on or something, we get an inset promo from fellow Slick protege, the One Man Gang.
There's a lot of bad rap going down on the Slickster. Will you people lighten up on the Slickster, because he's the greatest manager in professional wrestling right now. I believe that, and the Natural believes that, and he promised us to take us all the way to the top in the WWF.
Slick really was a good manager for the One Man Gang, keeping him relevant through 87, and then when things started to slip, he got him in contact with his African roots and transformed him into a way that would extend his career and make him relevant a little bit longer. Now, Reed goes up top. Graham hits him in the gut as he comes off. But Graham's not going to go on offense because there's no offense there to speak of. So now we got to do the smoke and mirrors routine where Slick is up on the apron and he is slingshotted in with the thing where Slick grabs the ropes and Graham kind of, you know, rides it, and then he flips into the ring. But he can really only bear hug the Slickster, which does look mildly impressive because Slick is a very tall, skinny man, and it looks better when you're doing that to a narrower frame, at least. And there's kind of a long delay leading up to that, like he was stalling. Almost seems like he was waiting for something to happen. He gets the bear hug on, and sure enough, the One Man Gang hits the ring. And the attack on Graham is on as the gang and Reed go to work on him. And Reed holds Superstar down. By the way, the crowd is chanting for Hogan because we always expect the world champion to come out and save every freaking mid-carder. Which, by the way, it would have been good for Hogan to actually make the save here considering how much he stole from Superstar Billy Graham's act of the late 70s. I feel like that would have been a good payback, but from a storyline perspective, it does not make sense for a guy like Hogan to be meddling in mid-card feuds like this, even if it did main event Madison Square Garden, but that was because of the unique nature of Graham, who he was, and the fact that it was basically a de facto goodbye. And Gang lands the splash on the injured hip, and Bruno pretty much lets us in on what's happening here, is that they're trying to end Billy Graham's career, and they're succeeding.
I'll tell you what they're doing. They're going to end his career. That's what they're trying to do.
They're going to send him back to the doctor again. You mean to tell me we're going to have to watch one of those bloody operations?
I'm glad Jesse brought that up, because I don't know why somebody greenlit a surgery on TV that aired in June of 87. To promote Billy Graham's comeback, as somebody really should have spoken up there and, you know, put themselves at risk so that we don't have to watch actual vivisection on weekly television. This is airing in the morning on Saturdays, and kids are watching this, and we're going to see Billy Graham's hip get cut open. That's not good. And at the end of that audio, you could hear the crowd start to murmur, and Don Morocco is now hitting the ring to rescue Billy Graham, and Reed gets chucked to the outside. He goes to work on the gang as well, and now Graham ends up on the floor as well. And then Tony Schiavone's favorite people, the medics, are at ringside, and they pull a stretcher from under the ring, which I found fascinating that they didn't take a stretcher from the back, they just took one from under the ring, and it was one of those ones that had the sticks on the side, effectively the same stretcher that Bruno got carried out on after Larry hit him in the head with the chair in February of 1980, and other stuff of that time. It felt like in stretcher technology, did we make any progress from 1980 to 87? I feel like there should have been a better stretcher on hand in Syracuse, New York on that night. And we get as Morocco is tending to Graham on the floor, and Reed is kind of distracting him, and he kind of pulls Morocco away. And then in a production snafu, I mean, I can only call it this, they go back to the hard camera, and you can see the One Man Gang kind of sneaking around. Graham is laying on the floor because the medics are still kind of tending to him. And the One Man Gang, you just see him in the corner of the screen fly up in the air for the big splash. And Vince calls the move, but we can't really see it all that well. It's something that, I don't know, maybe it kind of makes it funnier that the camera didn't catch it correctly. as the gang just gets in the one final cheap shot, which they sell as, well, he did it on the floor, so it hurts more than in the ring because it's on concrete, even though there's, you know, the blue pads have long since been established there. So you can see it happening. Morocco chases them off with a chair. So this is an okay way to write Superstar Billy Graham out of the Survivor Series. You establish immediately his replacement. Vince's weird loyalty towards his dad's guys, like Graham, and like having Bruno around through the beginning of 1988 just as a broadcaster, kind of shines through on that because he keeps Morocco, keeps Graham as Morocco's manager all the way through up into June of 1988. That's going to be, you know, 6-7 months before you get another injury angle at the hands of Greg the Hammer Valentine, which I covered many episodes ago in episode 24. So I got to say, I'm running out of Billy Graham angles for me to cover, at least from a WWF perspective, because I did the return in 86. I did when he gets put out in 87 today. I did when he gets put out as a manager in June of 88, and God forbid they send him to the broadcast booth at that point because he starts doing all the house shows. And then, of course, he's the champion in 1977 for that episode I did fairly recently. And then the seventh episode I did, he comes back. This is during Karate Billy Graham, which, God help me. God help me, Karate Billy Graham. And he rips up the belt after much labor of Bob Backlund, and Backlund is very upset about it, setting up that late 1982 feud. So this was certainly worth a try to try and elevate Morocco on the babyface side because he's a proven heel. He just kind of was a little bit stale, I think, in that role. He could be, he was proven as a top heel. He had a 3-month program with Hogan in the middle of 1985 at MSG. So it's worth it to give him a try on the other side and at least just see how it works.
All right, hi again, everyone. We are coming back to the Boston Garden Saturday, December the 12th, 8 p.m. I know my good friend, broadcaster Sean McDonough, will be making his way out to the Garden for a terrific night.
That was actually the transition from the Billy Graham angle into this interview segment. It went direct like that. And Craig DeGeorge is a little too cheerful about a guy who basically got his career ended. At least Sean Moody would sell it like, ugh. And, you know, he'd have like kind of that voice of like seriousness. And it's almost as if, though, they didn't let DeGeorge know what was coming on right before this. And also the weird name drop with Sean McDonough, who I suppose would have been available to go to that because his main gig in late 87 would have been as the studio host of Boston Bruins hockey, but for the road games on WSBK 38. And on that day of the house show on Saturday, December 12th, there was actually a Bruins game in the afternoon with the house show starting at 8 p.m., allowing plenty of time to set up. And Steve Bennett, my podcast partner on the Adams Division podcast, might be interested to know it was a Buffalo Sabres Boston Bruins game that ended in a 3-3 tie. Remember ties? They were so nice. We didn't have to have shootouts or 3-on-3 overtime nonsense or any of that. Buffalo blew a 3-1 lead in the second period of that game. Adam Creighton scored 2 power play goals in that one. Jeff Cortinall notched a pair for the Bruins just a couple of months before he was traded off to the Edmonton Oilers in exchange for Andy Moog. So despite the name-dropping and the cheeriness of Craig DeGeorge there, we get Randy Savage. So it's gonna be made good, okay, because it's a Randy Savage interview in 1987. Like I said, he's the most interesting man in the world at this time for the nature of his heel, of his face turn, where he doesn't have exactly one moment, unless you want to count when he started manhandling Jimmy Hart on TV in, I believe it was around September. And it's rather interesting in that, and you know what? I'm even going to forgive Randy Savage for calling it the Boston Garden, so I'm going to give him a one-time exemption. But the interesting thing to me here is we know about the pairing of the Macho Man and, or Macho King, and Queen Sherry that would last a couple of years from 89 through 91. And we've established from the earlier promo with the Honky Tonk Man that Peggy Sue is Sensational Sherry, and it's kind of out in the open. So it's kind of fun to see them opposing each other here.
I'm reaching past Jimmy Hurt all the way up, lightning bolts from the sky, yeah. Bringing it down all the way to the Boston Gardens, yeah. A specific and undesirable, yeah. I'm talking all the way. Mega power, yeah. Undesirable for a honky-tonk man, but it's specifically meant for you, man, yeah. And I understand that Sherry Martel in the corner, yeah. With Jimmy Hart suspended way above the ring. Beantown could not answer to the Macho Man Randy Savage if I didn't take the beaner. Yeah, you honky tonk man. And bring it from one end of the building all the way to the other end of the building. Because I predict after the Boston Gardens, yeah, it's going to be like the Lakers versus the Celtics, but multiplied by 10,000 times. Because I'm leaving the Boston Garden with not only the Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship belt, but the ladies! Heavyweight championship belt. Yeah, Sherry Martel, that finger is meant for you. Yeah.
Good promo. And I'm going to ignore the part where he is addressing Sensational Sherry and says, this finger is meant for you. I don't want to know what that means. Whatever is going on behind closed doors between consenting adults is none of my business, okay? If he can do whatever he wants with his fingers with Sensational Sherry, that's fine with me. This is a judgment-free zone. It's like that gym, except for that guy who got arrested for running around naked because he took the ad literally that is a judgment-free zone. So the finger is meant for her. Okay, that's fine. But I was thinking about how they're opposing each other, and from a kayfabe perspective, and I have the hat on and the chin strap buckled, Sherry must have gone through this feud and this experience playing Peggy Sue as sort of out Sensational Sherry as Peggy Sue and gained a measure of respect for the Macho Man Randy Savage, and that's why she was so eager to represent him when WrestleMania 5 passed just over a year later. I think that does make a lot of sense. One last thing about Savage in late 87. I was new to the Boys and Girls Club because you had to be 8 years old to be a member at that time. So I was on an intramural soccer league that they had there. It was indoor soccer because it was getting towards the winter time and you couldn't really play outdoors. And the name of my team was the Savages. And it was kind of an introduction to me to learn various wrestlers because I think there was the Hulks, there was the Giants, and I think there was 8 teams and they were all named after WWF wrestlers.
The Dragon's back and breathing some fire. Got you next week, Honky Tonk. Going around playing a tune, stepping on people's feet, pushing women down. Think you're big time now. Bragging about it. Having a good time with that belt. The only one that's going to be pushed down is you. Next week, way down.
You looking for trouble? You come to the right place. And next week, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, I'm going to prove to you and everybody else that I'm the greatest Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion of all time. I got a special tune picked out just for you, Dragon.
Why, yes, Steamboat did get a rematch for the Intercontinental title some 5 months after losing the belt to Honky Tonk Man, which I did cover back in episode 49, that episode. Do check that out in the archives and all the other episodes as well. And another kind of feature match that you would throw on there during sweeps to pump those ratings. And Graham is carried out to close the show, and we don't get the usual Vince McMahon of, well, he's going to be okay, folks, the way you usually would when a babyface would get beat down. He was not protective because he knew that was the end. And that is pretty much how they wrap on Superstars of Wrestling, WWF, from November 14th, 1987. It's going to be no YouTube comment theater because the video is not on YouTube right now. And no extra segment as the show is running a little bit long this week. But what I can tell you is what is going to be on next week's show, which will be something very, very new for me. A new promotion entering the fold at episode 76, excuse me. And this would be Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And this one is actually on the WWE Network. I believe it is the second to last episode that is available for the year 1994. And I don't think there are that many Smoky Mountain episodes on the network. It is not as many as I remembered. I thought that just about all of them had been added, but there's nothing in the final year of the promotion. But in this case, I'll be looking at Smoky Mountain from July 24th, 1994. and a rather infamous promo from the gangsters, namely New Jack, where he gives a shout out to everybody's favorite former Buffalo Bills running back. More on that next week, as we also see the thrill seekers, Lance Storm and Chris Jericho. And I can't wait to cover a Lance Storm match that doesn't have Chris Candido in it. That'd be a nice change, unless, of course, it actually does have Chris Candido in it, because he was a staple of Smoky Mountain Wrestling all through 1994. Thank you so much for listening. Go ahead and give the show a review on iTunes. 5 stars is always appreciated, and I appreciate your help and support in raising awareness of this podcast. Provide social proof that people are listening and enjoy it. Drop whatever on Reddit. I don't really know much about Reddit or how that works, but you know, if somebody asks for a podcast recommendation, tell them about Greetings from Allentown, because I always appreciate when you do that. And tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.